Child running wild in woods of Lissadel. Young lady from the big house. Seen in a flowered dress, gathering wildflowers. Ascendancy queen of Hunt's house parties, practical joke. Who could foretell, O fiery shade, impetuous bone, where all was regular, self-sufficient, gay, their lovely hoyden lost in a nation's heroine. Laughterless now the sweet domain, and the gaunt house looks blank on Sligo Bay. A nest decayed, an eagle flown. The Paris studio, your playboy count were not enough, nor castle splendour and fame of horsemanship. You were the tinder waiting a match, a runner tuned for the pistol's sound. Impatient shade, long-suffering bone. In a Balalaik cottage you found a store of Sinn Féin papers. You read, maybe the old sheets can while the time. The flash lights up a whole Ireland which you have never known before. A nest betrayed, its eagles gone. The road to Connolly and Stephen's Green showed clear. The great heart which defied Irish prejudice, English snipers, died a little not to have shared a grave with the 14. Oh, fiery shade, intransigent bone. And when the treaty emptied the British jails, a haggard woman returned and Dublin went wild to greet her. But still it was not enough. An iota of compromise, she cried, and the cause fails. Nest disarrayed, eagles undone.
Countess Constance Markovich was a West of Ireland woman, one of the Anglo-Irish. In middle life, she changed her role from that of Lady of Leisure to ardent activist within the Labour and Nationalist movements in Ireland. From 1910 until her death in 1927, she founded the Fianna, she became a leader in the Irish Citizen Army, she was deeply involved as a Labour leader in the lockout of 1913, she joined Cumann na mBan, fought in 1916 and campaigned in the War of Independence. She was later a minister in the first government. She fought on the Republican side in the Civil War and died just before De Valera's decision to take the oath, a decision she would have been reluctant to implement. The Gorbooth family had a reputation for being good landlords in Sligo. So what moved Constance Gorbooth to change from a stance of benevolence to one of revolution? Her family opposed her activities, and to this day, Aideen Gorbooth, her niece, still at her home in Lissadel, recalls the time with regret. She describes Constance's childhood as a happy one.
I think very lively and a lot of riding and fun, I think. And I think she had also had a canoe. I've seen photographs of it. That this is when she was fairly grown up, that she used to paddle around the bay, and I think they used to do a little bit of sailing and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And did she hunt?
Oh, yes. She was very fond of hunting. And she had this cob who, somebody told me when it was pensioned off, his legs were as clean as... He never had any injuries or anything, and she was always in the first flight. She had very good judgment as to where to jump and that, mm-hmm. which is rather necessary in rough country.
Mm-hmm. Were the family a bit upset with her by getting so involved in politics?
I think very, yes.
Can you tell me something about that? I mean, do they, in fact, really not want to have anything more to do with her?
Oh, no, they didn't take that attitude, but I think they thought she was foolish, and I think also that they were very worried. I mean, I know my parents were very, very worried when she was condemned to death, and they went everywhere to try and get it commuted. And even though my father definitely had quite a different outlook, he never barred the doors on her. She was always welcome to come home. She came. And I think somebody asked her when she was at the height of her... asked him, rather, when she was at the height of her activities, how he felt about her. And he said, "She's just as dear to me as when we were children picking the daffodils together."
Mm-hmm. And what about the politics? Was there any element of pride at what she had achieved or that sort of thing?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't exactly think that, but I think it was rather muddling for us as children. As you can imagine, we asked questions and that, and my father always said, well, she had the courage of her convictions and left it at that. Mm-hmm. He said we'd nothing to be ashamed of in her, but I don't think... Personally, I don't think violence achieves anything, you know.
Did you hear how she actually got involved initially?
Well, somebody told me that she was very impressionable and was some political speech she heard on a carriage step somewhere. I don't know who it was, actually.
She was presented at court?
She was, yes. And she was considered very, very good-looking. When I grew up first, I met an old Lord Weems, and he told me that she and her sister Eva and my grandmother were the three best-looking women he ever saw.
Do you know anything about her work or her life as an artist?
Yes, that I do know a little bit about. I know she went to the Slade in London. She had a terrible job to get to it because, you see, in those days it wasn't considered proper for a girl to go to an art school, and she was 30. Before she was allowed to go for 1 hour, the chaperone, each day. Well, then she was considered so very promising. She got off to Paris, and that's where she met the Pole, who she subsequently married.
Mm-hmm.
And as I show you around the house, I can show you quite a lot of her work.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the man she married? They spent long periods of their married life apart. Does he or did he ever keep up contact with Ireland afterwards?
Well, I don't know how much contact he kept up. His son came back in the 40s and... No, it was in the 30s, I think, was it? And it was in Dublin, and he was in... I think that was his son, not her son. It was her stepson. But he always sort of wrote to my mother and things like that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Were they close, do you think, the stepson and the Countess?
I think so, yes.
Mm-hmm. What about her own daughter? Where is she now?
She died. She was a very sad figure, really, because she felt that her mother didn't care for her, because she abandoned her at the age of 6 and went into the Rising, you see, and it left a terrible impression on this child. She thought she wasn't wanted, you know.
And what happened to her?
Well, my grandmother was very, very kind to her and looked after her and made a home for her. And I think she did rather a foolish thing. She sent her to an English school, which, I mean, you'd have to have a good sense of humour to get over, you know, your mother needing Rising in this country, and rather difficult for a young child to combat with, I think, perhaps.
Mm. Did she talk much about her mother? Was she curious about her mother? Was she fond of her?
I think she was fond of her, but I think she felt that she had let her down very much. That was the sort of feeling she had about her. And I think poor Maeve had a sad life, really.
The light of evening. Lissadell. Great windows open to the south. Two girls in silk kimonos. Both beautiful. One a gazelle. But a raving autumn shears blossom from the summer's wreath. The older is condemned to death, pardoned, drags out lonely years conspiring among the ignorant.
Sean MacBride is the son of Maud Gonne MacBride, who was friendly with Countess Markovitch since their days together at art school in Paris.
Oh, she was very dynamic, full of action, much more action-orientated than mother in a different kind of way.
In what, where was the difference?
She was always up and doing things. Mother would be quite happy to sit down and paint and sketch and then do things, but Madame Markovitch was always on the go, on the move. She would never stay put for a very long time. Where the Vindicators then concentrated on forming the Citizen Army in the early days of Citizen Army before the war.
Mm.
And then in founding the Fianna.
What sort of a person was she that you heard of or that you recall?
I think she was very good company. I think my mother told me that she was very lively. And my mother and she were very great friends, apart from anything to do with my father, I think. And I think my mother could have known an awful lot about what was going on, but she felt that she didn't really want to know because it would be a very difficult position to be in, wouldn't it? And then when my Aunt Constance was dying and they went to her, my mother told me, this doesn't please Irish people, but my mother told me that poor Aunt Constance was very sad about her life and said if she'd had to lead it over again, she wouldn't have done what she did. She didn't think. And she thought if she had a life like young people have nowadays and can develop their talents and do all different things like women can, you know, she wouldn't have done it, she didn't think. But then that doesn't please people at all, you know.
Yeah, what sort of education would she have had?
Well, I think she had a governess. I think they had a German governess.
And she wouldn't have gone to formal schooling then?
No, I don't think so. I don't think anybody who sort of was reared in a house like that. or very rarely did mm-hmm. go to a school at that stage. My brother Angus said that he heard that she could play the piano and that she used to accompany her husband when he was singing Polish songs in the Viceregal Lodge.
Was she somebody who was into women's rights in that sort of
way? Well, she was a suffragette, you know that, I'm sure. And apparently she was helping Eva, who was in Manchester at this time. That was her sister, my other aunt, with the suffragette agitation or whatever it was. And for some reason she was driving a coach and four through Manchester, and a man shouted up at her, "Can you cook a dinner?" And she said, "Yes, but can you drive a coach and four?"
And I joined Fina probably in 1917 or so. She was quite active. She would turn up and quite very active. And I remember the first election campaign I ever took part in was her election in 1918, I think, 1918 elections. She was standing for a constituency in Dublin, which I think would be about the equivalent of Dublin South Central. Yeah, I knew she set up the Department of Labour. She was first, and I think the only Minister for Labour in the world at that time, the first woman Minister for Labour. And she was very active in setting this up and establishing a relationship with the trade union movement.
I deplore the idea that women's role is not a companion or a friend, but a beauty, holding dominion by her careful manipulation of her sex and her good looks. It would be better for women to dress suitably in short skirts and strong boots. Leave your jewels in the bank and buy a revolver. Don't trust to your feminine charm and your capacity for getting on the soft side of men, but take up your responsibilities and be prepared to go on your own way, depending for safety on your own courage, your own truth, and your own common sense, and not on the problematic chivalry of the men you may meet on the way. The two brilliant classes of women who follow this higher ideal are suffragettes and the trades union or labour woman. In these lie the hope of the future.
Margaret Skinner was second in command to the Countess Markovitch in the College of Surgeons during the 1916 Rising.
Then I saw the British soldiers coming down Harcourt Street. The Countess stood motionless, waiting for them to come near. She was a lieutenant in the Irish Citizen Army, and in her uniform and black hat with great plumes looked most impressive. At length she raised her gun to her shoulder. It was an automatic which she had converted into a rifle and took aim. The shots rang out and I saw the two officers leading the column drop to the streets. As the Countess was taking aim again, the soldiers, without firing a shot, turned and retreated in great confusion. Madam discovers 67 rifles and 15,000 rounds of ammunition. This had belonged, no doubt, to the training corps of the College of Surgeons and would have been used against us had we not reached the building first. On Wednesday, I did little dispatch riding and spent some time with Madam sniping from one of the semicircular windows in York Street. I could look across the tops of the trees, the British soldiers on the roof of University Church. Reading of hundreds of thousands attacking one another in big wars and open battle, this exchange of shots between two buildings across a Dublin street may seem trivial, but to us there could be nothing greater. Every shot we fired was a declaration to the world that Ireland was demanding her independence.
For her part in the rising, Countess Markovitch was condemned to death and imprisoned in Aylesbury Prison in England. From there she wrote to her sister Eva.
Dearest old darling, the one thing I've gained by my exile is the privilege of writing a letter. But there's very little to say, as I don't suppose that an essay on prison life would pass the censor, however interesting and amusing it might be. What you have called my misplaced sense of humour still remains to me, and I'm quite well and cheerful. I saw myself for the first time for over 3 months the other day. It's quite amusing to meet yourself as a stranger. We bowed and grinned, and I thought my teeth very dirty and very much wanting a dentist. And I'd got very thin and very sunburnt. In 6 months I shall not recognise myself at all. My memory of faces is so bad. I remember a fairy tale of a princess who banished mirrors when she began to grow old. I think it showed a great want of interest in life. The less I see my face, the more curious I grow about it, and I don't resent it growing old. It's queer and lonely here. There was so much life in Mountjoy. There were seagulls and pigeons, which I had quite tame. There were stop press cries, little boys splashing in the canal and singing Irish songs, shrill and discordant, but with such vigour.
She that but little patience knew from childhood on had now so much, a grey gull lost its fear and flew down to her cell and there alit and there endured her fingers' touch and from her fingers ate its bit. Did she, in touching that lone wing, recall the years before her mind became a bitter and abstract thing, her thoughts on popular enmity, blind and leader of the blind, drinking the foul ditch where they lie. When long ago I saw her ride under Ben Bulben to the meet, the beauty of her countryside with all youth's lonely wildness stirred, she seemed to have grown clean and sweet, like any rock-bred seaborne bird, seaborne or balanced on the air, when first it sprang out of the nest upon some lofty rock to stare upon the cloudy canopy, while under its storm-beaten breast cried out the hollows of the sea.
Sheila Humphreys was an active member of Cumann na mBan. She first met Countess Markovitch after her triumphal homecoming from prison in 1917.
But I do remember the time she was released, mm-hmm. and we all went down. She, you have that photograph where she was sitting up in the car, and we nearly went mad because she was released separately from the men. Actually, really, she used to be half in the moon at lots of these meetings, you know.
Really?
Yes.
In what sense?
In that she thought all this kind of thing was an awful waste of time. She was a person that would like to get things done, mm-hmm. just like she went out in 1916, mm. get results. Mm. And I think she hated meetings, and she hated arguments, and she hated all the hair-splitting we used to have all our lives. We spent our time hair-splitting on principles that weren't principles at all. She was, indeed, half the time she used to be. She was a great painter. And great, and she'd always managed to have some kind of paper and a pencil, and she'd be sketching either some of the members that were there or, and as I say, when we'd get into petty discussions, you could see Madame would let her thoughts go someplace else altogether. Mm-hmm. But Madame had a wonderful way. Well, she didn't have to say anything. She only had to stand there and the people would go mad because of what she was. And she did. She never paused, and she was very interested. She tried to get us all taught elocution. She did teach us herself, actually. She had classes because she wanted to. She was like that. She wanted to bring younger people on, you see. And we'd all say we couldn't speak, and she'd say, well, there's no such thing as you can't speak. You can speak. All you've got to do is to start and to have courage, because of course she had such courage. But she had a great command of language, and then spoke very clearly and very nicely too, mm-hmm. as well.
She was released from prison after 1916. She had a wonderful homecoming, and she's in Liberty Hall. And I'm sure she had stopped in London. She had bought a lovely hat with an ostrich feather in it, you see. And she was wearing her old cardigan at the same time. And the first I saw her was on a sidecar with a jivey who looked just delighted with himself. And there was she with the ostrich feather and the cardigan. And the next thing, that would be in a newspaper, we
came up from Wexford for a day in Dublin, and I had made up my mind to bring something to the Liberty Hall kitchen where they had food for the people after the big strike. They were still running that kitchen, and there was Karin Markovitch in the ladling out, I don't know what, food of some kind, and she came over and we spoke to me and we had a few words like that. And then I went home and I got a letter from her, and it was a thrill to me. But when my family found out that I'd had a letter from Countess Markovitch, my grandmother cried, said, "That evil woman bringing young girls to their destruction."
Why did she say that?
Yes, just the bitterness after anyone who wasn't for you was against you.
Moira Comerford, another colleague in Common Amman. Moira Comerford spoke of Madam's daily work.
Stunting. She was a stunter. I don't think she was... I have found no evidence that she was a good Labour minister.
Really?
But it is true that Labour courts were invented, were started at that time, and that there was an interchange of people to do judge or justice, whatever you would like to call them, between the ordinary Sinn Féin courts and I think probably the land courts and the Labour courts.
When you say that Madame Markovitch was stunting, what do you mean by stunting?
Turning up here and there, wearing disguise, dressed up as an old woman with a basket, throwing it all away and getting up and making a speech. And it was so effective. Her constituency was the St. Patrick's Division, and the police there were determined to... I have seen a circular, and whether it survives or not, a direction to all the barracks to have a cyclist ready and to send word immediately if the Countess should appear in their area, and that they would at all times have a van and a whatever was necessary ready to go and catch her with no other duty in the castle. And they did catch her. But that's what she was at. I call that stunting.
Countess Markovitch made a major contribution to the treaty debate in the Dáil.
I rise today to oppose, with all the force of my will, with all the force of my whole existence, this so-called treaty. First, I stand true to my principles as a Republican and to my principles as one pledged to the teeth for freedom for Ireland. I stand on that first and foremost. While Ireland is not free, I remain a rebel, unconverted and unconvertible. There is no word strong enough for it. I am pledged as a rebel because I am pledged to the one thing, a free and independent republic. I know what I mean, a state run by the Irish people for the people. That means a government that looks after the rights of the people before the rights of property. My idea is the workers' republic for which Connolly died.
It was in the Civil War, I think, I knew her most. Had most to do with her. She was always willing to speak at meetings and do anything we'd ask her.
When Fianna Fáil decided, when De Valera, in other words, decided to leave Sinn Féin and start Fianna Fáil.
Can you tell me what happened, and was there a meeting, or did
you? Oh, yes, of course. We had two or three meetings as to whether we'd approve of the new suggestions, and when we found that Madam, can I just
understand.
Madam was going to. It nearly broke our heart, because to lose Madam was something awful.
What about the end of her days? She seems to have sort of gone downhill rather quickly.
Yes, 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 she did. Well, of course, you know that there was a fuel strike shortly, I think, after that. And she had an old car that wasn't easy to drive, wasn't easy. And she took that car down to the nearest bog she could find and got it filled up with turf to bring back to people in Dublin that had no fires. And on the way back, it stopped. And she got out herself and tried to start it, cranked it up. And it backfired. And she broke her arm trying to do it. And I don't think she ever really recovered after that. I never remember her at a meeting or anything after the time she broke her arm, going down for fuel for the people who had none.
Would you say she died happy with the way things had gone?
Ah, no. She couldn't have.
Did the Countess know what she wanted?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, she did.
She had a clear picture.
Ah, yes. She had a clear picture.
What would you say, in to use modern parlance, were her politics?
Well, of course, she was always on the side of the underprivileged and the underdog. She certainly would have liked a socialist republic. Definitely. She'd never have put up with what we accepted, finally.
We were very, very rigid about the not accepting the treaty. She would have liked to stay on, you know, and still be, still follow De Valera into politics. No, we weren't having that.
You don't remember anything at all about her daughter or her husband?
No, I saw him, very tall, very, I suppose, dignified figure. He didn't go the whole way with her, you know, on drama or other things. I don't think he did.
Mm.
And he was inclined to stick to his class.
Was there ever the feeling about the Countess that she alone knew, you know, and that she would dictate?
Oh, I wouldn't think so.
No?
I wouldn't think so. I know. She wouldn't have been labelling out the soup herself, you know. When I went in, she'd have been bossing the place.
Where did she die?
In St. Patrick Dunn's Hospital. In the ward. It was said that she was insulted. Kevin O'Higgins had been shot. And somebody resentful of that had said things to her. But then that's contradicted. It said she got very, very kind treatment there before she died.
She opted to join Fianna Fáil.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that? Did it surprise you?
I think it surprised me a little bit, yes. And I disagreed with her on that. I remember discussing it with her. And she felt that it was the only option to make progress. I didn't agree with her at the time.
Why did she? Did she, if you discussed it, she felt
it was an opportunity of making progress. Of pushing forward and making progress and regaining some of the positions we'd lost in Civil War. No.
Was she a woman who believed in doing, getting on and doing something herself, or did she believe in working within a group and within a movement?
I think she believed in working within a group and within a movement, and liked to have the discipline of a movement. I think that operated very much her mind in 1916, Citizen Army. And then afterwards in the labour movement, trying to work with the labour movement, unify the labour movement into something worthwhile.
But what do you think her view would be of how we developed as a republic?
I think probably very disappointed at the lack of economic progress. I think she shared, to a certain extent, on economic matters, she shared a good deal Bulmer Hobson's views. Though politically she didn't. But I think she regarded Bulmer Hobson as being the one person in the Republican movement that had sound economic views.
The Coughlin family home in Rathmines was a great Republican refuge right through the Troubles. It was there Countess Markovitch spent her last years. Louis Coughlin was a child at the time and remembers Madame vividly.
She lived in my mother's house, yes. Mm-hmm. She came there out of jail after, I think it was after the Civil War, and because she had no house of her own. She had furniture stored someplace, but I don't know anything about that. There was a nationalist house. It was always in the Tan Time. We were never raided in the Tan Time. It was a nationalist house, but we were raided after the Civil War. Well, we all loved her. I think we loved her because she loved all of us. There were 9 of us in the family, and she loved all of us.
Did she like children?
She loved children. She really loved children. She was happiest with children.
Because there was the feeling that she had somehow or another deserted her daughter and that this was because she had no feeling for children at all.
No, that is absolutely untrue, totally untrue. The thing of leaving her daughter with the child's grandmother was not... she wasn't rejecting the child. It was just that she was in the political movement and she was going in and out of jail and things, and in and out of 1916 and that. And the child didn't suffer at all by it. The child had a wonderful time and was more suited to the life she had in Sligo, in this ascendancy-type house, because she was that kind of person. And I know she didn't hold it against her mother, because she often visited her mother later on. And they weren't as close, possibly, as other mothers and daughters might be, but there was no animosity.
Now, how about how she dealt with you children, the Coughlin children?
Oh, we had a wonderful time with her. We really had a wonderful time with her. She used to... she had this old Model T Ford that she loved. It was her heart's delight. And she would take us all out in it, out on picnics up the mountains. And she used to always take her sketchbook with us and leave us running around the mountain. Whenever she'd be going anywhere in the old Ford, she would be playing out in the garden. And she would just come to the top of the steps down to the garden. And she would just shout, "Children, children, come on, we're going out." And we would all file into the car. And she would take us off Grafton Street, anywhere she was going.
Did she go into great elaborate preparations for these picnics?
Oh, no. No, she would take us all again into Grafton Street, into Fuller's. It was always Fuller's. And she always bought a chocolate cake. Now, there'd be an awful lot of us in the car, but it was always the Fuller's chocolate cake. And we would go up to the mountains with this, and we would each get a piece of that.
And that was the entire...
That was the entire picnic, yes. They had offices in Suffolk Street, where Sinn Féin had offices. But if she were going there, she would always... she'd just bring us to Woolworths, tumble us all out of the door, say, "Go in now and have..." I don't know whether she gave us a penny such happens. I don't remember that. But what we were to do in Woolworths, I don't remember. But we always enjoyed it. And then when she was finished in Sinn Féin offices in Suffolk Street or wherever, she'd come to the door of Woolworths and say, "Children, children," at the top of her voice. Well, she always spoke very loudly. And we'd all come running. We'd all get into the car. And nobody took any. Now, we didn't think it was any very odd.
Did the rest of the people around?
Everybody thought it was very odd. We drew an awful lot of attention wherever we went with her. In this Model T.
Is this because of her voice?
Well, the whole thing was odd. Having a whole lot of children in the back of this very old car, and she always drew attention to herself because she was very tall and didn't dress absolutely conventionally.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So we always drew a lot of attention to herself.
When you say she didn't dress conventionally, how did she dress?
Well, she always had the long thick stockings and the big shoes. And she had a wraparound skirt always, a kind of a tweedy wraparound skirt and some kind of a jacket. And she used to use this wraparound skirt purposely, I think now. I may be making this up because the Model T was always breaking down, and mostly up in the mountains. But anyhow, it was always breaking down. And she used to do all the repairs herself. She had a Model T Ford book that she called her Bible. And she prided herself on always being able to mend it the car. So she would whip off the wraparound skirt, and the long legs with the navy blue bloomers would be show, and she'd get in under the car, and these long legs would be sticking out under the car. That drew a certain amount of attention too.
Was she into the daily hurly-burly of politics at that time?
Well, yes, earlier on I'd say, well, towards the end now, as far as, I don't remember that much about it. She was always around the house. She always did the garden. She did, it was a very big garden, and she took control and did it all. We used to steal her strawberries and raspberries and loganberries, and she used to get very cross. But she used to give us, I think it was penny a dozen for snails, if we gathered them in the garden. And she loved the garden. Now, her car took up an awful lot of time. And she taught herself Irish from a book. And what else? Well, she was always on the edge of politics anyhow. People were always coming and going. And, of course, there's Fianna Éireann. And people always visiting her. And De Valera used to come and visit her, not very often. And he would always send a runner along beforehand, because he didn't want any people around when he'd be coming. Everybody had to be cleared away. He was very conscious of his own importance. And of course, she called him the chief, and she adored him. She really adored him.
Well, the whole question remains unanswered, whether or not she would have taken the oath. Can you remember any discussions on how she felt about taking the oath when Dev decided to stop it?
Very, very distinctly I remember them. She adored De Valera, as I say, but she was going to have great trouble in taking the oath. I know this disturbed her a lot, and I know there was great discussion at the time she died that at least she wasn't faced with this problem of having to decide to take the oath or part with De Valera, as I say, whom she adored.
Mm. It would have been very difficult for her.
Absolutely impossible, I say. She was very, very conscious of the poor of Dublin, and she tried in every way to help them. She wanted to join them. She actually went so far as to try and get a flat in one of those blocks of flats where the poor were in.
Oliver Bond flats?
Yes, that's it. And that didn't work because she couldn't be accepted by the poor on their own level. You know, she was too different. And some of them loved her, some of them mocked her, of course. But when she'd go along to them and she'd find them in poor... I have seen her carrying sacks of coal up on her back, up long flights of stairs, to poor people in these flats.
Would you say there was any truth in the possibility that at the end of her days she regretted her whole involvement in 1916 and politics and in and out of prison?
Not at all. Not for a moment did she regret any of it. Not for a single second. She would have done it all again the same way.
You're quite sure of that?
I am quite certain.
What has time to do with thee? Who hast found the victor's way to be rich in poverty, without sunshine to be gay, to be free in a prison cell. Nay, on that undreamed judgment day, when on the world's scrap heap flung, powers and empires pass away,